All right, I got Jessica Hutchison on the show. She is a therapist specializing in grief, traumatic loss, and she's the podcast host of Honest Women. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Pumped to be here.
Yeah, likewise. You know, we were talking offline, and so I'm just, there's so much to cover in this episode. I don't know if we're going to be able to, but I really want to get into the nitty gritty. And, you know, when we were talking, I was just like, man, what even makes like a grief, like how do you specialize in grief? Like, don't all therapists do that? But before we do there, like, obviously there must've been a pain to purpose story. Like, how the heck did you get here and get into therapy and then this grief work specifically?
Yeah. So Joel, you're spot on when it comes to grief. Most people don't choose grief. In fact, I usually say I never chose grief. Grief chose me. And this whole path to going to sudden and traumatic loss and grief work, yes, comes from my own pain. So 6 months after I graduated from grad school, I lost my dad to suicide. And there lies the pain that I have now turned into purpose. And half of what led me to this specialty, honestly, is going to a bunch of therapists who had no idea what they were doing. They clicked the little grief box or little, you know, thing on Psychology Today or whatever profile saying they did grief work. And now I am realizing they did not actually do grief work. So here I am trying to undo so many things that therapists do.
Yeah. And talk to that notion of that, because again, I think we think, you know, if we're looking for therapy or, you know, I used to be a police officer. And so talk about PTSD and trauma and grief that we might not even realize that we have, you know, we just go down, we don't know any better as police officers or even just anybody out there looking for, to do deep work. We just look in a Rolodex of therapist. Like, I need a therapist. I need a marriage counseling therapist. And that's it. And we just go, let me try her. But the more I've talked to you, it's like, no, like most of them don't even know how to handle grief specifically. They've went to talk about just the schooling and like how much grief work is even covered in, you know, when you get a degree.
When I got my degree, and now mind you, I graduated from grad school. I was a career changer. So this was back in 2011. A lot has hopefully changed in those 12 years, but all I learned was a very, very small chapter in one of the very large textbooks that I went through. And here's what's funny. Okay, I have to get on a quick soapbox. One of the things we studied was the stages of grief. God bless Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She was the first person to normalize death and dying. However, she never intended for those stages to be applied post-loss. She actually went into hospice centers and hospitals and did interviews with people who were dying. And these were the stages they personally went through before dying, which makes a lot of sense. They're very linear when you look at it that way. Now, at the time, since we didn't have a lot on death and dying, we decided as a society to apply the stages post-loss. We still are doing it today, to the point where I studied it in grad school and I walked into therapist's office who gave me the stages of grief. If there is one thing I want to do in this world, it's get people to understand that the stages of grief are never for post-loss, okay? I'll get off my soapbox, but I'm going to keep talking. So when it comes to grief, there's different variations of it. Now, we have our circle of life death, right? Which was my only experience with death and dying when my father died. It was grandparents. It was circle of death. There's almost a beauty to it, right? I've heard people say it's an honor to be able to grow old because so many people are not able to. They die prior. I understand that now. There really is a beauty in it. Now, when somebody dies suddenly, tragically, violently at a young age, this completely flips a person's world upside down. Circle of life death does not do that. Not only that, there's the whole trauma component of it where our brains can't conceptualize what it is that just happened. It happened too quickly. So now you've got trauma that's lying over any type of grief work that can happen. So what therapists can unexpectedly do is drive people right into the trauma. Tell me about the death. Let's start going through the stages. How are we going to mourn the loss? And if you have somebody who has post-traumatic stress symptoms, which is pretty much everybody I know that I've worked with who has experienced any type of sudden loss, you're keeping them caught in their trauma. Talk about doing a substantial amount of damage to the psyche in that moment. So that's why I say traumatic loss and grief are completely different.
Wow, that's really good. And that's just so nuanced. It's just it's a little shift. And again, from the outside looking in, I would have no idea. I just would go in the phone book, look for somebody that I think specializes in this work, but I really wouldn't know. What's also interesting is you just mentioned that the brain, and I do a lot of work with just chronic pain. And one of the things that's interesting in my background as a holistic health coach too, is that the brain, yes, it's really smart, but it can also be really stupid. And so it gets in these pain neurofeedback loops. So anybody that's in a chronic state of pain, but I see this, and I'm imagining it's also for loss. The brain has a memory, and unfortunately, the brain is trying to protect you. And so it never wants you to get injured again. Let's just use an injury or loss. It doesn't want you to get stuck in that. But what it does is, because it's hyperactive and always trying to protect you, we see this a lot with autoimmune disease also, is that it creates this pain neurofeedback loop that is dysregulated. And so the brain becomes always on guard, always trying to protect you. Even though the pain is gone, your body's healed, it's moved on. Do you see the same thing then in grief work? I'm curious.
Oh, absolutely. And you have to remember, when somebody is suddenly taken from you, there is this disconnection that happens. There is a constant state of yearning that is now overlapped with a hyperactive nervous system, right? So when we continuously talk about the way in which somebody died and we're in that traumatic state, it keeps our bodies connected with the death story. So then I'm glad you talked about the brain. Here's another little piece with the brain is you see a lot with grief and sudden and traumatic loss, the same activation as you do with addiction. So a reward system. So our brains can actually start rewarding us every time we talk about the way in which somebody died, which then, like you just said, smart and very dumb. So then our brain starts saying, my connection with the person that I just lost is the death story, is this horrible, horrible event that just happened. But in order to stay connected with them, I have to stay connected with the death story. And now you have somebody who is consistently caught in a hyper-aroused state.
Wow. That's crazy. On that note too, of what you just mentioned, grief being the same in the brain. And I remember that there was some study that I had read about, and it's equivalent to that, like a really bad breakup shows up in the brain, I think, it just as similar as like someone dying. So, and it made me think like, wow, so no wonder, you know, people do crazy things when they get in a breakup or a divorce or something like that, because to the brain, it can't tell the difference. It's exactly the same as if someone dying. And then you think about how people react. Sometimes people, they murder their significant other because they are so it hurt them so bad. And so talk about that too. And just like probably what you're seeing in the grief world, it's like, you know, you would think someone comes to you and they're like, I just had a bad breakup, but it's actually way more than that, mm-hmm. because of what the brain is interpreting.
Oh, yes. This is why I say there's grief in everything, not just death. And when we look at loss, so divorce is a really big one. Now, majority of people do not get married thinking, maybe, right? 50-50 here. Maybe I'll stay with them. Maybe not. We'll see, right? We get married and we start forecasting our future the minute we decide we're going to be with this individual. It's not even at the ceremony. We envision kids. We envision grandkids. We envision all of these beautiful things, right? So then a rupture happens over and over. Two people decide to get divorced. Well, not only is it the loss of that relationship, it's a loss of the entire future that you had planned. Now, I see this with couples work that I do, and people coming in and saying, gosh, you know, I decided to get a divorce. Let me rewind here, because not to toot my own horn, but I haven't had any couples get divorced yet. However, I also will say my job is to not keep you together, but if you're here, that's a good sign. Anyways, women, though, that I work with, I will have come in and say, nobody in the world has any empathy for this divorce I'm going through. They keep thinking I should be happy. And yes, maybe there is some happiness, but there's a lot of grief, sadness, and sorrow because it's a loss of what somebody thought it might be. I would also argue that I think if we focused on the loss of what things could be and stayed there a little bit longer in society, we might see a drop in divorce rates. Hypothesizing here, have zero to back that on.
Okay, so that's really interesting, because what you just said, I just read, I can't remember what book, because I'm reading like ten books at a time. But talking about, I want to hear about more about that, because this idea of mental subtraction being a very positive psychological tool, and that idea, and I think it's from like the Christmas movie or The Wonderful Life, where he shows what your life will be like if you don't have any of these things. And I feel like that's kind of what you just said, using this idea of mental subtraction, like imagine what your life will be like if you don't have this. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And I'll tell a personal story here. When I lost my dad to suicide, I was, how long? Just over a year married. So any newlyweds there and who are thinking like it should be more fun or easier than it is, no, it's not. That's just what like Hollywood tells you. Marriage is really hard, especially in the first year, let alone when you lose a parent to suicide, right? So what I found out on my journey of bad therapy, essentially, is that one, I thought I was the problem. Clearly, I'm not doing this right. Then I started looking at everything around me, and I moved here from another state when I was in my early 20s. So all of a sudden, I started looking at Chicago. I was in the city. Okay, maybe I'm not supposed to be here. Maybe Chicago's making me unhappy. This profound pain that I'm feeling, maybe it's the city. And then I'm looking at my husband, and I'm thinking, or maybe I made a really bad choice here. Maybe it's him. Maybe he's the problem. And this marriage should have never happened. And I attached that belief to my marriage. And almost, it was very close to severing ties at only a year at that moment, because I attached a belief that my pain, my sadness, my brokenness was a result of my circumstances and all of these other variables in my life, instead of realizing that it was me that had been broken by this horrible thing that happened, and I needed to piece that together. It was nothing else on the outside. And I am forever grateful that I realized that, because I see people leave marriages all the time thinking that's the cause of their pain and their sadness and their sorrow. And it works for a little bit. And I'm not saying this is for everybody, but a lot, it works for a while, works temporarily. And then all the same stuff catches up with you. And now you're separating kids and you're not seeing them. And you have so many more losses that follow that one loss.
Because you never took care of the root cause.
Correct. You never got to the root. You never got to the foundation.
Yeah. And I can totally relate with that. I mean, there are so many times in my own marriage, and I've told you my story, and a lot of people know it, of being married for 11 years, and probably like 9 or 10 of those years were just terrible. And luckily, we stuck it out, and now we're in the best place possible. But it took a lot of deep work and a lot of unraveling. You know, as I'm listening to you talk, though, I'm wondering, how do we know then if we need to be – how can someone know, if they're listening to this podcast, how do they know, you know what, I need to work with Jessica or someone who specializes in grief versus another type of therapist or counselor, because I almost feel like all of this is coming back to the root cause of, like, you could almost correlate everything back to grief or loss. So how can someone distinguish that?
I think you have to look at the meaning that has been applied to it. And I'll give you an example. Healthy, I don't like to use the word healthy, but, you know, meaning for me, right? I don't know that I necessarily have a solid narrative about pain that I have gone through and with my loss, right? And that's not the only loss I've experienced. That's just the one that happens to be a pretty big one. However, I know that because of that profound pain that I experienced, I am living a much more authentic life, and I have found a lot more purpose. I have applied my own meaning to this awful, terrible experience. Now, when somebody comes in and the meaning they have applied is the world is unsafe, I cannot trust anybody, I want to be alone because that's the only way to protect myself, well, that tells me that this person is stuck. They're stuck in what clinically is called acute grief. That's the clinical term, and they have not been able to integrate it. And so if somebody's listening and they feel that sense of fear, kind of being caught in fear, I'm so afraid of losing somebody again. I'm so afraid. I need to protect myself. The world is not okay. That might be probably a good sign to look for somebody who specializes in this type of work.
Yeah. Great, great, great stuff. Okay. I want to dive into a couple other things, but I want to know, okay, so what's the solution? Clearly typical normal therapy is not working. Right. And all the other types that you've told that, you know, people typically go through or what you even went through, and you're like, this isn't helping me. And you had to actually figure it out yourself and go to other many, your work is an amalgamation of everything you've learned and all this, your own personal studies. What should people start doing right now? What are some action steps? Obviously they should come see you and do some deep work. Cause that's,
I'm like, come true. See me. Yeah. Come see me. Let's talk. No.
It's never, listen, I mean, and I think I know this too, like, go out and read all the books. There's great books. There's coaches. There's so many good things you can do. Meditation, like, do all that stuff. At the end of the day, what I found is I want to hire coaches and people that can move me there faster because they know the frameworks and they're going to get me there and they're going to hold me accountable and give me feedback, okay? Mm-hmm. Feedback, and I can reiterate, and then I speed up the process and I can get through it. They've already gone through it. You've gone through it. And that's why someone hears this, they can work with you. But what are just some strategies or some things that they could start doing right now?
Yeah. And not everybody has to see somebody individually. I, in fact, had probably the most healing with a group. I ended up meeting with a group that was specific to survivors of a suicide loss. I was resistant to the idea until I had no other choices, really, had failed attempts of finding help. And that was unbelievably helpful. There is a healing power in groups and connecting with other people who have experienced that same loss. I personally am a little biased in that I think the best people to help people through grief and traumatic loss are people who have experienced it themselves. There is a reason why when people are fighting addiction, a lot of the times the people who help them the most are people themselves who have struggled and are now in recovery. There's a deeper understanding of it. Yes, there are lots of great books out there. One day I will write it. It's on my wish list here. But there is, I mean, start taking a look at what is traumatic loss? What is sudden loss? And what am I expecting from myself as a result of this experience? There's not a one size fits all with this because of our attachment system.
Ooh, okay. We got to talk about attachment. Let's go there next. But you mentioned earlier in the show about addiction and how you see, I believe what you said is you see a lot of people that have addiction tendencies or just addictions. A lot of it stems from grief. Is that correct?
It can. No, it was more the brain.
Okay.
So addiction definitely can come from unprocessed trauma, right? So if we just look at addiction at its core, there's substantial unprocessed trauma within the individual and an inability to work through and regulate their system. So they turn to a substance for help.
Yeah.
But with the reward system, so with the brain and grief, it activates the same reward system as a lot of substances that we become addicted to.
Right. Okay. Okay. Yeah. I was just curious if, in your experience, if you saw a lot of people that have addictions, alcohol, drugs, whatever, if those people tend to come to you as well, because there's usually some type of traumatic loss or grief. I was just wondering if there's any tie in there. That's what I was kind of thinking, but.
Yeah. You know what? I've only had a couple people who struggled with addiction. I haven't necessarily seen somebody who didn't already have addiction as an underlying kind of struggle that they're going through, but it become one. I think just trauma in general, though, unprocessed, especially when we're looking at first responders. I mean, that's a big one, right? Of unprocessed trauma, and they have nothing else to turn to but a substance. And that can also be food, right? It can be, it's not necessarily just drugs and alcohol, but essentially, if the brain cannot conceptualize what happened, we are not applying meaning to it. What does this mean in a positive way? Well, then yes, we start looking at different substances or ways to escape the pain of our reality.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I've mentioned before, but I don't talk about too much, is that I was involved in an officer-involved shooting early on in my career, my first like year and a half out, and nobody was hurt. I shouldn't say that. The suspect was hurt, but none of the officers were hurt. My partner ended up getting fired from the job. So it was traumatic for me, and also just being in a violent altercation like that. And I was telling you that, the department at the time, this is like, 15 years ago, they thought they were cutting edge by, they made sure that I saw this shrink before I went back on duty. And it was one time that I saw the guy, just once. That was it. And he asked me how I was doing. I'm like, I'm 25 years old. I'm like, I'm feeling fine. I mean, I don't have anything really major. But I went back on the streets, and for about 6 months, I couldn't stop my hand from shaking when I would talk to suspects. And that, I didn't tell anybody. I just kept that inside. And you just think about, like, again, this work, but it's like, I think about it now. It's like one freaking session you made me talk to a guy, and then you thought, Joel's good. Like, let's put them back together. And they wanted me back on the streets within a week. I ended up going back in 2 weeks. And it's just crazy to me now. And I mean, what would you say now, even just hearing that story, and you're thinking like, dude, you got some work to do. You got to jump in the gym with me, and like, we got to do some work. How do you see that? And I'm just giving that as an example in terms of unprocessed, I don't know if you'd call that grief, but just trauma.
I wish that it had changed. It's changed. I have not seen that. If somebody who's listening has seen it happen and there's a specific department, please let me know. I would love to see it. But I have found that with first responders of any type, even we're talking FBI, police, firefighters, whatnot, right? They believe and have been trained to shut it off. That's just not, unless you're a robot, a lot of people can't. There are a handful of men out there and women who can do that. I have yet to see it. It's interesting because I've worked with some first responders. I've worked with some people from the FBI too, who have substantial trauma, and they will all come see me offline and please don't say anything because there's such a fear of job loss. If you do not, I won't run this through my insurance, because if they see I'm seeing somebody, then they're going to think something's wrong with me and they're going to fire me and I can't be fired. There's almost fear and trauma related to working through the trauma that comes. And so then you've got a lot of activated individuals out there who are trying to help people. Again, not everybody, but that whole situation where I'm like, they sent you to a shrink one time, the reality of the situation hadn't even set in. You don't even know what happened. You're in a state of shock for a good chunk of time. So of course you were okay. Well, I see that with traumatic loss. If somebody comes to see me right after, like the couple weeks, even like a month or two, I hesitate to tell them. And now I just do every time I tell them, you're going to hate me in like a month or two. And they'll look at me and be like, why? And I'm like, because you are in this beautiful fog right now. It's shock. It's your brain's way of protecting you from the reality of just what just happened. And in like another month or two, the bottom's going to give out and you're going to look at me and be like, what did you do to me? You're messing me up here. And no, it's just shock wearing off. And so you going and talking to some shrink once right after the incident, I'm like, of course you were fine. You were in shock. We're all okay in shock. It was probably weeks later or months later when your hand's shaking and you're like, whoa, whoa, what's going on? What's wrong with me? Nothing. Shock wore off. And now the reality of what just happened is catching up and you're stuck like, what's going on here?
Yeah. I'm so curious why you have so many FBI agents that are stressed out. Most of them are just pencil pushers. I'm just kidding. Sorry. That was just a bad joke. Sorry, FBI. I know there's some of you guys that are out there in the field. Most of you guys are in the office, but
I did. It was field people. It was field
okay.
People.
These guys were in the field.
I was actually like really fascinated. It was fun.
Let's go back. You mentioned attachment and I read a great book called Attached.
Love that book.
It taught me a lot about just the different attachment styles. And it was eye-opening for me because I saw a lot of the patterns that it was showing up in my own relationship, in my marriage, and really that I, go figure, have an avoidant attachment style. And so I'm very good at isolating, shutting down, detaching, getting away. And guess what? My wife has an anxious attachment style. So we just mesh just perfectly. But for those people that haven't read the book or don't know anything about attachment theory, why is that? You mentioned a couple of times now, why is attachment, why is it such a crucial part in the relationship and that you see it playing out a lot?
So this is where the leap comes between grief and the couple's work. People tell me all the time, how are those two related? And it's attachment based.
Should specify, Jessica, we didn't really talk about it, but you've kind of mentioned it. Your works, you specifically do a lot with grief, but you also do couples therapy. So you do a little bit of both. But what's funny is, like, I think you're going to tell us is that, guys, I see a lot of cross pollination. A lot of these things are intermixing. And someone would think to themselves, I don't have any problems with loss, Jessica. I have problems with my marriage. And then you're like, actually, no. So yeah, talk about attachment and where this all comes in.
First, let me just tell you that the avoidant, anxious, that's the number one thing I see. I think it's like the basis of American marriages, like avoidant and anxious attachment. Now, when it comes to grief, you really can see the trajectory of how somebody is going to grieve based on the attachment they had to the person that they lost and their just primary attachment style. So the most likely people to seek out therapy post-loss are going to be your anxious attachment people. Same with couples. I pretty much know who's going to be my more anxious one in the relationship because they're the ones to call me. And the other one's like, why am I here? And I'm like, oh, okay, there's my avoidant, right? What's interesting with grief is that anxiously attached people often grieve in a more predictable manner because they talk through it so much. Avoidant people, it usually manifests physically. So you see a lot more physical ailments with avoidant. They're also the ones that aren't going to say they need therapy, right? They're just going to stuff it until they're sick and then there's a problem, right? but with marriages, okay, so I am trained. Let me, real quick caveat, if you are going to see a couple's coach, therapist, whatnot, interview them on what they're trained in. Please, I forever believe that no couple's coaching or therapy is better than bad couples coaching and therapy. Lots of divorces are a result of, again, people who are practicing outside their limitations. Off a soapbox again. Now, I am trained in emotionally focused couples therapy, which is all attachment based. So essentially what I do in my sessions is identify each partner's primary attachment style. So I run them through my own real nice book of attachment, right? And they answer questions. I get to dig in on my avoidant people who are like, my childhood was fine. It was great. My mom was awesome. I don't know. It was fine. And I'm like, okay, okay. I sometimes say my specialty is making my like avoidant husbands like cry in my office, but from like a place of emotion where they're like, I don't. And the wife's like, I didn't even know you had an emotion in there. I'm like, yeah, it's like my secret hidden talent. But our attachment impacts our marriages, right? So being an avoidant attached husband you're going to naturally go the opposite way when you feel like there's conflict. And guess what? An anxiously attached person is now going to feel that pull away and is going to say, oh my gosh, you're abandoning me. You're leaving me. You're leaving me. You're leaving me. And they're going to come at you harder, which you want to see a good fight. Have an anxiously attached partner back the avoidantly attached partner into the corner. Oh, it gets real pretty then, right? And so then the avoidantly attached person will usually just spout off, get all angry, say a bunch of stuff, and then they're the jerk, right? They're the ones with the problem. So that's where the overlap is we really get to the root of what is your attachment style and how do we see that playing out within your marriage? So a lot of marriages are built on really faulty foundations because of attachment. I also, when I do my attachment like questionnaire, big thing, I will find loss. I find loss all the time and I will dig in and I will say, oh, you suddenly lost your mom when you were 12. Anxiously attached person will start crying, right? Like it was horrible, like, but I'm okay or, you know, whatnot. Depending, avoidant will be like, yeah, well, that was so long ago. I'm fine. Why is that a problem? And I'm like, okay, cool. So we haven't worked through that yet. I can see, you know, but you see that a lot. And what we don't talk about is how like past loss or past attachment styles impact our marriage. You probably experienced it firsthand with your anxious and avoidant attachment styles.
Yeah. And actually, I'll use our marriage and our backgrounds as an example. So, and I want to hear some of your feedback. So I have an avoidant attachment style. Do I have any specific loss or grief? Not that I can remember. Now, my mom, who I think is the one who I really sought love from and approval. I remember an old incident where she basically, what's a good way of saying that? She dismissed me. I got a 95% on a spelling test. And she's like, why didn't you get 100? And I just remember feeling just broken. Like, if I don't get 100 on tests, like, my mom doesn't love me. Mm. Did she mean that? Of course not. But, like, that propelled me and drove me to, like, always try to be successful and, like, good in my mom's eyes. Now, same thing with my wife. Did she have a traumatic loss? Not that I can think of. However, her father separated from her mother at, like, 3 years old. So she really wanted her dad's approval and love, and he was never there. And she actually lived with him for a little bit, and then he was never in her life. So he left, like, let's just say 3-4 years old. So now you have the two of us coming together. And the funny thing, I was dying laughing when you were talking about people going from how they interact. When historically we used to interact this way, I would shut down and I would be like, I'm leaving. You're yelling. You're being loud. I'm not going to talk to you this way. I would leave the room. My wife would follow me. Like, oh, you have to answer me. You have to give me a response. And I'm like, you're acting childish. That's how I thought. But anyways,
you probably said that too. I mean, knowing husbands and wives, you probably said that.
I never said you're childish but in my head I was thinking that. But I'm wondering, you know, was there in our relationship, there was clearly no sudden loss or dramatic loss for my wife, more so with her dad just like not being there, being absent, and with my mom being emotionally absent. Is that enough that you say, Joel, that's grief, man? That's grief. That's loss.
For sure.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Because here's the thing: is for our generation, we didn't talk through anything. Okay. And we're kind of undoing that now. And I think a lot of multi-generational trauma is going to be stopped with our generation because we're working through so many things. Now, what we know about the brain is that if we don't we have to have a narrative. So if our parents get divorced, my parents got divorced at two, I think that's when it was. If mom's not talking about it or dad's not talking about it and they're not sitting down with us and saying, you know, here's why we're separating or we're going our ways or blah, 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 which if she's a child of the 80s like me, there was probably a lot of not talking about why we're getting a divorce and sometimes even bad talking about parents, right? About one another. Now, our child brains have to make meaning out of that. And when we have 3, 4, 5 years of life experience, that meaning is pretty bad, right? Like, I was bad. I made mom and dad fight, and that's why they got divorced. Now, a lot of times that's not in our conscious awareness, that narrative, but it's in our attachment system. I wasn't good enough. So that's why dad left. Not logical, right? So now that starts to become our narrative of not being good enough. And that's why people leave. If I'm good enough, then people won't leave. And our brains will look for evidence to support whatever narrative we have. So if you can think about how detrimental a 3 or 4 year old's narrative of not being good enough and how much evidence you can find. So now, fast forward to marriage. Have you ever seen what's the old video with the still face?
Yes, I know. Yes. Exactly what you're talking about. I know that. Yeah. I know that experiment you're talking about.
If your listeners don't go look at it,
it's so heartbreaking.
Now, yeah. Here's what we know: adults have that exact same process. So yeah. Then, when if I'm anxiously attached and I have profound fears of not being good enough and my partner leaving. So now if I'm your wife, right, and you say, okay, you're yelling, I'm not doing this more, and you leave, it's not logic. It's all in our emotional part of our brain. Our attachment system says, you're leaving me. You're abandoning me, right? And so what am I going to do? I'm going to follow you, and I'm going to tell you why you should not leave me. Right? It's like a total adult temper tantrum. Don't you leave me. Where are you going? And I need a reaction out of you. And what we know about the attachment system, because of the still face experiment, is that any reaction is better than no reaction. So even if you yell at me and tell me I'm being crazy and to go away, it is better than if you ignore me.
I mean, I'm just laughing and smiling because you nailed our relationship for many of our years. And I think you're right. I mean, she just wanted a reaction from you. Like, give me something so that I know that, like, you care. Like,
you care about me. Yeah. And the avoidant, you know, and I bet if we really dug in, there's more than just that one memory of mom, right? I think that was probably more the tipping point of other events that happened, right?
That's one of the most memorable that I can remember. But of course, there's more, yeah.
But think about, right? I mean, that is clearly, why would I go to somebody to get my emotional needs met if they're not going to meet them? So if that's the narrative, right, I have to do X, Y, and Z in order to get this person's love. You're going to find evidence to support that. I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy of this person's love. So the difference between anxious and avoidant from a marital standpoint is anxiously attached people will pursue. That's what we call it in the emotionally focused world. We'll pursue. Where are you going? Where are you going? Where are you going? Avoidant people will go back. I don't feel like I'm good enough. I can't deal with this situation. I need to leave. I need to disconnect from this situation. I need space to deal with my emotions. That's really the difference, is how we either lean in or lean out.
Yeah, big time. The third attachment that we haven't even talked about, the secure attachment. Now, here's the interesting thing, and I already know you know this, but for the mm-hmm. audience who doesn't know much about attachment theory, the funny thing is what you just said earlier is that anxious and avoidant attachments, they're most popular. Now, unfortunately, because of that, guess what? All the anxious and avoidant people are getting together, and then they're probably breaking up, but they're getting together. And so there's a massive pool of these people. Not as much of a pool of secure attachment, because if someone's secure, they're probably in a pretty good relationship, right? Would you say
they're not going to? Yeah. Here's what's interesting. If an anxiously attached person is attracted to a secure person, they actually just don't activate their anxious attachment system. So it just works. Yeah. And it's also not a death sentence for your relationship. This anxious avoidant, we can rewrite attachment systems and make them secure, even if that's not where our primary system was.
I'm living proof of that. Yes, so, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You can create a secure attachment within your marriage. It just takes some work.
So I wanted to ask you a little piece. If people are listening to this, I think we want to push everybody closer to the secure attachment. If someone's listening, what's one thing, or what can they start doing to create a more secure attachment? And again, this takes a lot of deep work, man. It took me 11 years, and I definitely could have sped it up if I had done some other things, but it does take some mastery. It takes some deep work.
It really does. And there is this false sense that secure attachment means no pain, no argument, no conflict, which is inaccurate. In fact, for a secure attachment to be created, there has to be a rupture. So if we go back to childhood, half the reason a child will have a secure attachment with their parent is because when they needed them, they fell, they had a nightmare, mom or dad was there to help them through it. That is how we create security. So in marriage, you need the rupture. You need the arguments. You need the fight. What we don't talk about and what we don't teach is the power of the repair. And we love Americans love a quick fix, right? We know that. So let me tell you what's not a repair. Sorry about last night. That was really bad. Okay, cool. I'm going to go to work now. That is not a repair. That is a brush off. That is sweeping it under the rug. Right? This is why it takes deep work is one, you have to go within yourself and say, okay, when I walked in the door and I totally popped off at my spouse, why? Why did I do that? So you're not necessarily going back to your spouse and saying, hey, sorry, I popped off again. I know that time of month, right? Like that's not a repair. It's being able to say, you know what? I had a really bad day. I was putting out fires and it really hit this button, right? Here's a deep work. It really hit one of those buttons that told me I can't depend on other people. Just myself. Just me in this world. I'm all alone. Then I walked into the house. And remember when you said you were going to get these things done? So when I walked in the house and I saw that none of those things got done, it really hit that I can't depend on anybody but myself. And I exploded. And that was not okay. I am really sorry for exploding at you. And I'm working on not exploding, but more so, how can we create some dependability within our marriage? Because it's really important for me to know that when you say you're going to do something, you are going to do it.
Ownership. Taking extreme ownership.
And I cannot stand, I am telling you, I am going to make a shirt one day that says own your, and I don't know if you can cuss on the show, so I won't say it, but I am going to make a shirt, like if everybody could just own it. But that does take a deep dive within ourselves to say what's happening for me.
I was just reading a book and it was talking about that very idea. And this person highlighted the fact that an Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the first things they do is admit the truth. They admit the truth because none of us want to face the truth because the truth is going to actually show us who we might really be. And that doesn't feel good always. And so owning it.
I actually think that 12 steps could be applied to anybody and anything in life. Like one, number one, right? Acknowledge you have a problem. That, I mean, literally all of us could go through these 12 steps. I love the 12 steps.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. All these different books I read, a lot of times they will refer back to AA because there's a lot of good work that's actually in the framework of it. And I've never actually seen all 12 steps, but it keeps coming up over and over again. And I'm always like, wow, like I should check out this program for myself. Like you said, I think it's like a self-development program. I should just go. I'm not addicted to alcohol, but I should just go and see what they have to say, you know? So,
you know, a big part of it is you have to face your shame. And that's what people get, you know, that's the stuff that keeps people stuck in bad habits, bad patterns is shame. It's not guilt. I love guilt. Guilt teaches us. It can help us do something differently. Shame is not good. And that's what the 12 steps definitely does. It makes you face your shame.
As you're talking, I'm just thinking, wow, what about our kids? Mm. Now, how is this attachment and how should we be leading as fathers, as parents? How we come into these relationships, like we just said, a lot of times not in a secure attachment, and there's all this conflict, and now we're passing that to our kids. Any suggestions? Or, I mean, that's a whole nother podcast, obviously, but you know, any just suggestions of how can we raise our kids then in a more secure attachment versus some of the crap that we are bringing into our marriages right now. And that's why we see conflict. We don't want our kids to face that.
My quick answer on that is the repair. Focus on the repair. And what I see parents get caught in is, oh, I lost my temper again. Oh, I yelled at my kid. Cool. Go repair it. Who cares if you lost your temper, right? We all do. We are imperfect. perfect humans. I wish I could say, and I know attachment theory pretty darn well, and I wish I could say that I have gotten it right with both of my kids from day one. In fact, full disclosure, I really think that I had a very anxious attachment with my oldest until the last couple years. We've really worked to undo that because of my own just reactive state in that and not knowing how to respond. But a lot of that comes from repairing. Hey guys, I'm really sorry I lost my temper earlier. You know what? That wasn't okay. But here's what parents do. Hey guys, I'm really sorry I lost my temper, but you should have put on your shoes. Guess
that's
what,
guys? That's not a repair.
Yeah. You were just telling them that it's their fault that you lost your temper. Just don't say that. Don't say anything before you say that. But being able to hold space for apologizing to our children. And here's the really cool thing about that is when I started doing this with my oldest, my daughter, she started mirroring it. You know what, Mom? I'm really sorry for X, Y, and Z. And then allowed me to say, you know what? It's okay. Let's start over. Boom. That's it. That's all you have to do for the brain to not store it as something more.
That is the greatest gift. And I think it is always so cool as a parent. Like, I don't want to say, you know, you've made it, because you've never made it. You're always adjusting and learning and pivoting. But when your kid actually starts mirroring the things that you're trying to teach and you're doing it by example, that is like one of the greatest gifts ever. I love when I hear stories like that in my own life. Man.
That's like when you do like the little dance. Cause I do a lot of like, oh, got it wrong. Oh, got it wrong. And those are the moments that you're like, woohoo, got it right. Got it right. Got it right. You have to take those moments that you get it right. Cause man, we as parents, it's hard, hard work.
Yeah. I know one of the big things I'm working on too is just because of my own patterns and how I was raised. And it's like from when misbehavior happens, like I just want to shut it down. I want to control it. Go figure. Ex-police officer wants to control things, the situation. And so when my kids are misbehaving, like I want to shut that behavior down as fast as possible and like let them know it's not okay and end it and just squash it out. And one of the things I keep coming back to, I think Daniel Siegel talks about this, but misbehavior is the sign that, right, that your child has gone offline. And guess what? That's actually when they need you the most. They need your help to come back online. And I struggle with that because I'm like, nope, you're misbehaving. You're bad. And actually, that's when I need to love you the most so I can bring you back online. So I know that's one of my big things based on how my attachment is and my own upbringing. So
there's so many beliefs that are rooted in that too. And I find with men, my fathers that I've worked with, is there's a lot of, if you're misbehaving, then you're being disrespectful. You're not respecting me. You want to dig a little bit deeper. It hits a lot of that I'm not good enough button, you know, all the way back to attachment. And now all of a sudden you have a adult who's telling their child to behave, but deep down inside it's because, well, if you're not behaving, then I don't feel good enough. So can you not do that anymore?
Jessica, you're speaking my language. How did you know I have self-worth issues? Yes.
Because we all do. We're humans.
Of course, of course. But that's a big thing with me is disrespect, and you're disrespecting me. And I, yeah, it goes back to that all the time. So yeah, thank you for saying that. Mm-hmm. So key. So key. I love this work. This is so good. Okay. I know we're getting up to the top of the hour. Talk to me. Exciting projects. You have any exciting projects or anything you're working on that we should know about?
Oh, you know, just a couple, because I love to overwhelm myself. No, I am actually working on putting a training online for those who are interested in being properly trained in sudden and traumatic loss and the grief that follows that and working with people. It is a continuing education program that I have given at the University of Chicago here, at Loyola University, and I'm finally taking it online so that it can be on demand. That is probably the biggest thing. Please go to my website. My website is www.jlhutchison, don't put the N in, HUTCHISON. And there is a subscribe button at the top of that where you can be notified when that training program does go live.
Love that. people are going to mess up on the name. You already know that. I think you need to get another domain like Dr. Jess or something. We'll just keep it even.
I know. See, I don't think about these things until after the fact. But don't get, well, I already bought Hutchinson. So you know what? If you type in jail Hutchinson with the N, it's going to take you to my website anyway, but no N. And then I also want to do, also want to say I do have a podcast. It is not centered around sudden and traumatic loss. It is a little bit different, but it's about honest conversation. It's called Honest Women. I am the co-host of that alongside Andrea, who is my co-host. We happen to be therapists. However, we do not show up really as therapists because we are firm in our belief that you all do not need an expert to tell you how to be different and live differently. And there's no tip or trick that's going to change it all. But we can talk about some hard things honestly, and that in and of itself can lead to a lot more change.
I love that. And I think conversations and stories, that's how we have evolved. Before they could, before people could write, right? It was all stories. And that's why we have such great memories when it comes, we relate to stories. So having conversations, it's a story, and people can learn a lot from that than just some kind of hacks or tips or strategies. So
yeah,
that's great.
You know what? And you know what? I've lived a life where I've read a lot of great books, but I've also read a lot of books that told me if I just do this differently or this do differently, I'm going to feel or be different. And then I felt worse because I didn't. So, you know, there really isn't just one thing out there that's going to change it, but there's so many good things that we can use as self-reflection.
Yeah, love that. All right, I want to wrap things up and do some final round questions. But before I do, anything I didn't ask you that you wish I had?
I don't think so.
Worst
but
case
again,
scenario.
I like think later, right? Like the website. So I don't know. And like in 4 years, I'll probably tell you yes.
That's fine. We'll have you back on again to discuss.
There you go.
The
love it.
I didn't ask you. That's no problem. I like you anyway. So we'll have you on. Happy to have you on again. All right. Just some final round questions. I'm curious for you, Jessica, were there any choices or a choice that you made that you think made you who you are today?
There's a lot of choices that I made. Every failure I have had, I've learned to embrace. I think I held a lot of shame for a lot of bad choices that I have made in my life instead of realizing that every one of those led to who I am today and has helped me relate to people in such a different manner. So really learning how to embrace failure has single-handedly been one of the best things I have done.
Nice. Love that. I'm a big reader. We're talking about books and you can't get everything from books, but are there a top like 1 to 3 books that you feel like really changed your life? And you'd say, man, go out and read this book, or maybe some people have multiple books, but go out and read this book. It really impacted me.
I am thinking When Things Fall Apart. Have you read that? When Things Fall Apart. It's a really good one. It's talking about just difficult times, how to embrace difficult times and the power of difficult times. It's an older book. I love that. I have read that multiple times. It's a good one.
That's
I
great.
Have a lot. I will say on my nightstand, I have a lot of books that are half read.
It's all right. I'll ask you. That'll be my next question. What are all the half read books that you'd highly recommend people read that you haven't finished?
You know, here's the deal with it, though, honestly, is some of these books just shorten them, right? Like they're just repetitive and you're telling me the same thing over and over and I don't have a long enough attention span for that. Yeah. So a good, you know, book, good short book. I can dig.
Yeah. Any rituals or practices or anything that you do on a daily basis? Are you doing cold plunges, gratitude practice? Like what do you do on a regular basis?
I am really big with my morning routine, getting up before everybody in my house. It is my time. I spend 10 minutes where I am usually reading something for that is a nonfiction based for my practice or for myself. I then meditate every morning. That is huge. I became avid with meditation during the whole COVID lockdown thing that was going on. I finally practiced what I preached. I will admit that. And now it is a part of my morning. And then I work out every morning, short 30 minutes in my house, nothing fancy. And that morning ritual is truly something that I protect.
It's massive. And I see that the high performers that I interview and just associate with, they all have some type of routine and they protect that time for them. And if they and that's really it. It's funny, I always tell people, like, you got to master yourself first before you can go influence your family or anybody else. And if you're not doing these basic things, then your bucket's not full and you can't go out and lead. You can't go out and own it like we're talking about, because you're just already dysregulated because you're waking up and you're just going all
over.
You're
just going. Yeah. And I am also I protect my sleep. I have learned how important sleep is. I prioritize that. And my friends always joke if I am out past 9 o'clock, which is very rare, and my bedtime like thing goes on and they're like, oh my gosh, Jess, there you go. You're supposed to be in bed. I'm like, I am. What am I doing here? I got to go. But I protect that. I really do, because I know how the body responds to stress and the importance of getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep, more so 8. But yeah.
Yeah. Agreed. Last but not least, Jessica, where can people find you? I know you already talked about it, but again, just a reminder, where can they find you, connect with you, learn more about all the good things that you're doing?
My website, let me say it again, www.jlhutchison.com. You can also find me on Instagram at jlhutchisonlcpc. I am there at Honest Women Podcast. That is also on Instagram. You can find me on LinkedIn, as well as my podcast is on all major platforms. So wherever you listen to your podcast, Honest Women, there's about 40, I think at this time, there's about 41 episodes we just launched last May. And yeah, you got lots of good stuff to listen to.
Amazing. Jessica Hutchison, appreciate you so much. Thanks for being on the show.
Oh, happy to be here. Thank you.
Boom.
90. What am I at? 98.